This is Smarter Collaboration. With the scale and complexity of challenges facing business and society today, knowing how to collaborate is now one of the most important skills of our time. Our host, Dr. Heidi Gardner, is the best-selling author of the book, Smarter Collaboration. She's a Harvard scholar and named by Thinkers 50 as the next generation guru. Researched back by 25 years in this field, Heidi takes you into the middle of collaborations from a variety of industries around the world. Enjoy today's special guest, Scott Green, president of the University of Idaho. Now here's Dr. Heidi Gardner.
Welcome, everyone. And today I'm delighted to welcome a leader whom I also consider a good friend, President Scott Green of the University of Idaho. Scott Green took office as the 19th president of the university in 2019, and before that was a highly accomplished executive with a career in global finance, operations, and administration. And he's also a proud alum of the university, which, if you don't know, they call themselves Vandals. So Scott is a Vandal. He graduated in 1984 with a bachelor's in accounting. I had the privilege of getting to know Scott when he was the chief operating and financial officer for Hogan Lovells, one of the largest law firms in the world. So when he moved to the University of Idaho and asked me to work with his leadership team there, I think I hesitated for what, maybe all of 2 milliseconds before giving an enthusiastic yes as a response. And Scott recently, on top of everything else that he has been doing, is the proud author of a very freshly released book. And Scott, if you will tell us more about that book in just a moment, we would absolutely love to know. I understand you just got your author copy. So give us a show of that, Scott, for, you know, when we can get snippets of the video up for our channels as well. And welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Heidi. So great to be with you. It's so good to see you again and have a conversation with you. You know, again, you've done so much for us. We're just it's always a treat to get together. So the book is called The University President's Crisis Handbook. And it basically is the story of really how the University of Idaho, how we've really tackled 3 major crises, literally in 4 years, once I arrived. One we knew about. And that was a financial crisis. But then, of course, we had a pandemic, which we all had to deal with, as well as a capital crime, unfortunately, within our city limits on 4 of our students. So this book takes us through how we handled all of that and how we tackled the financial crisis, how we managed to stay safely open during the pandemic. And of course, how we managed the capital crime that was committed against our community and our students. So, as you know, you've got a foreword in there, which we thank you for that very much. And I have a co-author. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Temple Kenyon, who's also a Vandal and has written some fiction. So she helped me turn this, rather than just a pure business book, into something that's more of a good story.
Oh, it is. It's a great story. I love how readable it is. I love how relatable everyone is in there. And one of the things, Scott, that is truly remarkable is you've got this incredibly readable book. You call it, you know, for university presidents. Clearly, you know, it makes sense for you to have written it in that way. But it's remarkably applicable in so many domains. And, you know, I think you did an incredible job of including your sort of notes from Scott and taking it into the business world as well. Tell us about how that came about.
Yeah, so, you know, I've written a couple other books on Sarbanes-Oxley way back in the day, but they're
super exciting topic.
Yeah, right. but you know, one that, you know, people would gravitate to because they had to implement it. What I really wanted to do was talk about business concepts, but talk about it in more of a relatable way for managers of all institutions, not just higher ed. And I think you're right. You know, we've had Eric Peterson, who's Lieutenant General of the U.S. Army, weigh in on the value of this book, from his perspective in the military. You know, Brad Little, the governor of Idaho, who kind of weighed in, you know, from his perspective as a leader of the state. And Kurt Liebig, who actually runs a couple of different businesses. And was the immediate past president of the State Board of Education, but, you know, believes it's a great business book as well. So, that's why I added, you know, components to this, but let Temple kind of run with the story and tell the story, because it is a good story to tell.
Yeah, without a doubt. Absolutely. And of course, I was thrilled and delighted to see that Smarter Collaboration plays such a role in all of the chapters and how you brought together that theme of people working across divides. And you talk about a lot of different kinds of divides that you had to overcome in the book. When we talk about Smarter Collaboration, we're talking about people from all different perspectives, whether it's life experiences or socioeconomic backgrounds or disciplines or even different colleges at a university trying to come together and address a complex issue. So of all of the collaborations that you write about in the book, which one are you most proud of?
Yeah, well, it's kind of a tie, and I hate to say that, but, you know, I mean, the fact is, you know, the way our community came together for all three of the events that we encountered, we're all special in their own way, and we have a lot that we can be proud about. I think probably the most difficult one, and so it's close to my heart, was just the first one we went through together, because people didn't know me. We had to build those collaborations that you so much talk about, and it was really have helped me and helped our university with in incredible detail. People were in their silos when we got here. It was a very broken culture. I like to say it's kind of like the television series, The Game of Thrones. You know, people were throwing each other under the bus and hiding in their caves, and it's because we had a lot of turnover at the top. Strategies kept changing. Financial crises came and went. There's an incredible battle with each other over resources, which happens when there's scarcity. And we had to get over all that, Heidi, and you helped us get over all that. And so I have to say, just getting through that first one was really important to us, and enabled us then to go on and become better collaborators when we had to face the other two crises.
Yeah, that makes complete sense, Scott. So, as you know, when we're thinking about Smarter Collaboration, if anybody's going to open up to another individual, especially somebody unknown, they have to have trust in them in two ways. Like, they have to have interpersonal trust in their integrity and their background. And I think you came in with that, right? You were a known entity. You're a vandal at heart. You had given generously over the years of time and all kinds of other resources that you had to keep the university, as best you could, on track and moving forward. And people believed that you were coming in for the right reasons. That's what I heard again and again. And at the same time, you had to earn competence trust. There were a lot of faculty, right? We've seen this in institutions around the world. Somebody comes in as a quote unquote non-academic, and you had to convince people that you couldn't just run, big global businesses with tens of thousands of people, but you could run a university, which is really its own beast. So walk us through the kinds of actions that you took to win over some of those skeptics.
Yeah. So none of this will surprise you. Steve Immelt, who was my former boss at Hogan Levels, who you've also done some work for, made the observation, which is absolutely true, that the faculty aren't unlike, partners in a law firm. With the senior partners, you can't really fire them. You can't fire tenured faculty. Both are incredibly intelligent populations, both are incredibly skeptical and have to be brought along. And so you need to work to identify those in each organization that truly matter, that you can work with, that you can build those relationships with, build that trust, and bring them along, and they will bring others along. As you point out in your networks, those who have more contacts will have more success. And so my goal early on was to, identify who those people were, and the faculty, and the administration and the staff who were influencers, and, communicate widely with the community so they all understood what the problem was, and then get those influencers out there on our behalf to, help spread the word, if you will, and build some momentum around what we had to do to tackle our financial problems.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's just wrap up that story of the financial problems. Where have you landed today, and kind of who can you credit along the way? What different kinds of people did you need to rely on to make it that success?
Yeah, we've had 4 years of surpluses. In fact, our first year, we generated a small surplus, which was shocking. None of us, including myself, thought we would get that far. But that just shows you what happens when you have people collaborating and you unleash that potential. The sort of things we did was provide financial information to our deans and to our vice presidents. We gave them targets. We continually communicated our progress, you know, throughout the year as things moved on. And at the end of the day, the community did more than we asked them to do. We were going to lose over $20 million. And I asked them to cut 14, figuring, well, we could handle that for the first year, and then we'd get the rest the second year. But they went the whole way, actually generating a small surplus, like I said, and they did that of their own initiative. I mean, you know, it's kind of a joke of 1,000 points of light, but you know, we had that. We had everyone working towards that goal, and we achieved it.
I mean, that also speaks to the power of creating that shared goal. I mean, you said it yourself, people were in their own fiefdoms, they were operating in silos, and they were competing, sometimes in the worst of ways, with each other for those scarce resources. And you managed to pull them together for that overarching goal. So I think that's, you know, a crucial point for people. And, you know, as leaders, it's easy to say, create a collective goal, but by God, that must have been tough.
Yeah, you know, you have to empower folks to execute. And that takes a lot of trust on our part too, right? That we don't micromanage. We set the goal. We let them know that it's their job to get there. We're there to help in any way we can. But at the end of the day, you know, their decisions are the ones that are going to drive us towards success. And that unleashed an incredible amount of energy on campus.
Yeah, I pick up on something small that you said, but it was really big from what I remember, which was setting targets and holding people accountable for them. I mean, that feels like a very obvious thing to do in a commercial setting, but it seems far less obvious in higher ed. And that, I think, was an approach that actually was kind of risky on your part, wasn't it?
Well, I didn't see it that way, but I'm sure others did, because you've read the book and you've heard what others said about that. but you know, from my point of view, you know, you shine light on issues and you talk about them honestly, and then you help people get there. So even though we held them accountable, and we did that through meeting every month with the deans and the vice presidents, where we weren't meeting our targets or our objectives, you know, we would dig into why and what we could do to help. And then we would provide the people or the resources, whatever they needed to help, you know, address that shortcoming. So again, it's making them part of the team as opposed to, you know, beating on them for not hitting their targets or making them a point of ridicule. It's what can we do to get you there? What else, if this isn't working, what else could we do, right? How can we help you?
Yeah. I remember we were together in that summer retreat, and it was such a watershed event. You know, you had your senior leadership team there, and people were coming in quite antsy, right? They didn't know what to expect. They didn't really know what we were going to do together. I'm not sure I had a ton of credibility coming in from the East Coast and you know, parachuting in. It's like, who is this person? And then by the end of those, you know, few days together, I think the culture shifted quite perceptibly, right? We could see that people were having conversations that they probably should have been having on a continuous basis, but had been holding off on for years. So what do you think allowed people to break down those barriers at that moment in time?
Well, you know, I'm not just saying this because we're on the podcast, but I think that you did bring a lot of credibility and you helped people see the light. And I think we had a lot of common common wins by that time. So the fact that you were able to point those out and dig into why those occurred and start to build that trust, like you said, that, listen, the reason we were able to do this is because we were working together. We were working across lines. And at that time, there was still an awful lot of resistance when we had that retreat, right? I mean, we'd been talking about collaboration. We had introduced you before. We had a lot of things going on. But at that retreat, I think it all kind of came together. It was very emotional at the end. You know, if you remember, at least for me. But we started to articulate all that we'd accomplished and all where we wanted to go. It was really powerful. And, you know, despite the fact that we had two crises that followed that, you know, the reality is that we were well prepared to address those because our team was operating in a very healthy way by then.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this idea of crisis is so important. And when in our research at Gardner & Co., when we've studied how people engage in a crisis, we tend to see the extremes. People either pull really tightly together, but for a limited amount of time, it's kind of all hands on deck and people put their personal beefs to the side, but then they revert, you know, back to the mean pretty quickly. Or you have people who isolate and duck into their silos and, you know, take more of a command and control approach. And it's remarkable, you know, as I was rereading the book before our discussion today, I realized that you had a different kind of a cadence there. You went from one crisis to the next, and you didn't fall off in between. Like that sense of we're in this together, you managed to sustain it somehow. And I'm wondering if you know what allowed you to do that.
Well, you know, I believe it's because we always were headed towards a goal and we were always articulating what that was. And even when we got, you know, let's take COVID, for instance, you know, it took us off our path for a while that we had to address for that. We stayed with developing the strategic plans for the future and we communicated what the future was going to look like, right? And how we were going to get there. But you're right. You know, when you're in a crisis like that, the pandemic was really interesting because people responded differently than the financial crisis. You truly had people, to your point, that just melted down. People who were normally strong, who all of a sudden just were unable to function. Others who just stepped up, who you wouldn't expect. And it's almost like one of those war movies where you see the, you know, the most incompetent person all of a sudden, you know, being the most effective on the battlefield, right? It was something to behold. And again, we gravitated to those people that were rising to the occasion, and we just kept moving towards our long-term goals. And we, you know, we really never lost a beat. We managed to keep all those balls in the air while addressing, you know, those issues. So that's a credit to the team. And again, it's collaboration because we were all stretched, but yet, you know, we just kept it moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me go in a different direction. You know, for you as a leader, I remember weren't you the leader of the student association back in your day as a student?
Yeah, I was in student government and I was in the Senate and vice president and president. So I was pretty active back in the day, made a lot of mistakes on campus. I learned a lot having done that. And it really, you know, it's the best. That's where campuses really are terrific. I mean, universities, you can make all your biggest mistakes there and learn from them. And there's not a lot of downside as opposed to when you go out of the real world, you know, and if you make those mistakes, there's a lot of downside. So really fond times of that. But yeah, I was definitely very active in student government back in the day.
So you've had experience as big man on campus, and now, you know, you come back as president of the university. I have to ask, you know, having seen you drive around in your big, you know, your giant truck wrapped in the logo of the university, and everyone knows you're coming, and you head out to some of these remote research locations, and people are coming out of, you know, out of their different buildings to see who's driving the Vandals truck and taking photos and posting them. I mean, through all of that, how do you keep your ego in check?
Yeah, well, that's something I did learn coming out of, when I was a graduate. I learned that, you know, being a bit humble is always a good thing to be. And realizing that life can take you a lot of different places very quickly that aren't always good, you know. So, you know, for instance, you know, when we were having a lot of success with our lab that we opened up in the pandemic and we had other universities looking to us about how did you do this and how did you do that? We helped them, but we didn't brag about it. We didn't go to the press with our success just because we knew we could be laid low at a moment's notice by COVID. You know, it was a powerful foe. And that's something I look for in all of our team, you know, is I look for people who are really competent, but also a bit humble. You know, they have a background of hard work and you know, may have had to, you know, had, you know, had some barriers that they had to break through to get to where they are. And those people you can always count on. You know, it's the ones who are, you know, the cognizant competence who always are, you know, singing their own song that, you know, aren't always the great collaborators, right? You know, getting back to, you know, why we're successful is because we were collaborating. It's because, you know, we were a bit humble. We wanted to work together and support each other. And so, again, collaboration is the key to our success.
And through all of that, you had to make obviously some tough decisions. You know, you alluded to those already. That one of the mistakes that I see, there's a leader that my team is working with right now, and he's holding off on making some of the really tough calls. He's been in role for a couple of years now, and he's really enjoying being at the top and being well-regarded and really well-liked. What kind of advice do you have for that person who has to make tough calls when not everyone's going to like his decisions?
Yeah, well, you know, bring the team with you, you know, put the problem on the table, let them help you solve it. And the more people that you can get signed up, then you can start to move the organization, but you can't ignore them. They just get bigger. And that was the problem here at the U of I, is that we had a lot of folks who were, you know, this was a stepping stone, and they had, you know, they didn't want to be the president that had to, you know, lay people off and make the hard decisions. So we made those hard decisions, and we did it as a team. And, you know, we did the low hanging fruit first. And, you know, we set our objectives, and we provided incentives for people to go out and accomplish these goals. And we got there, but it wasn't by fiat. It wasn't a command and control thing. It was by harnessing the energy that was on campus and, you know, to achieve that objective. So I would encourage him to sign his team up, you know, or her, and put that issue on the table and let the senior managers help, you know, drive the solution.
It takes a lot of to do what you're talking about. You're somebody who seems to have boundless energy. You know, I've seen you racing around from, you know, the women's soccer game in the rain and then off to important meetings and all sorts of things in between. One of the things that struck me in the book that was, I think, fantastic advice, and I'd love to get you to comment on, you know, how you personally put this into action. One piece of advice you gave to your readers is finally take care of yourself. A president cannot lead with energy and good judgment if not rested and healthy. It's easy to be overwhelmed by crime, the media, the needs of your employees and students, and the needs to communicate and take care of your team. All right. So that was, you know, one of the closing pieces of advice of a very difficult chapter in the book. You know, whether it's in under times of extreme stress or just the day to day, how do you really put that into action?
Well, you've just got to make it happen. And if you don't, then you're going to fail. And you know, again, you know, I can go back, you know, to, and maybe I learned this coming out of the pandemic. There was a point in the book that I needed to call the faculty senate chair because we were implementing some emergency procedures that really affected the power balance between the faculty senate and the administration. But I was exhausted. I was just exhausted. I'd spent all week dealing with petitions and you know, the Department of Health and, you know, COVID issues, you know, left and right. And I just couldn't and literally didn't get it done. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of fallout from that, but just because the chair of the faculty senate was a good person and understood where I was coming from. But, you know, that I was no longer effective at that point, you know, and I couldn't make good decisions and, you know, just literally physically just couldn't do anymore. And I think I learned a lot out of that. So, you know, fast forward to the crimes, and I made it a point during those crimes to take care of myself. I continued my workouts. I got up early and worked out. I was in bed early. You know, I was, you know, eating the right things. I was spending time with the right people. And I had a lot of time where I just had to have time to be alone to think through things. And we made time in my schedule to do that. And I would encourage, that was such a better situation than through the pandemic, the early days of the pandemic. And so I would encourage leaders, CEOs, and all senior leadership to make that time for themselves and to take care of themselves when you're in the middle of a crisis, because you're not doing anyone any good if you can't make good decisions and if you're not available.
I mean, that I think is total role model material right there. You know, talk about tone from the top. Somebody who is, it's one thing to have somebody say, oh, go take care of yourself and so on. And then, you know, not to be role modeling it. So I think that's, you know, absolutely crucial is people see you walking the talk. And, you know, I'm wondering, you talked about spending time with the right people. There are, you know, lots of folks who make time for quote unquote right people based on those other individuals, you know, status and what they can get from them and so forth. You know, when you said the right people, what did you mean by that?
Yeah. So, well, people who could help us get through the crisis. So I was spending time with, you know, law enforcement and building those relationships. I was spending time with our students who are grieving, you know, and understanding what they needed. You know, a lot of adults were saying you need to shut the university down. But the students, many of the students were saying, no, we need to be together. You know, I need to be with my friends at this time. And so, you know, by being with the right people, I mean, being out in the community and understanding what was happening so that we could make decisions that were right for us, not what others from outside our community were telling us would be the right thing to do. And I found that, you know, that approach incredibly helpful. You know, so the status thing, you know, I've never really looked at titles. It's like, what do we need to do next? Who do I need to hear from to make a decision?
Yeah, I think, you know, I can think of, and I'd love for you to explain some of the times when you had really competing objectives. You know, there are lots of situations in the book when you talk about stakeholders who had really very different views of the direction the university should take and what you as a leader should do. How do you reconcile all of those different views? How do you stay open and not become defensive when you're just getting hammered?
Yeah. So, well, first of all, yeah, you have to believe that people are reacting in a way for a reason. And if you can understand that reason, that helps you not become defensive. You know, my goal always was, you know, once we came to a decision, we would execute. And I just let my team know, look, you know, there's going to be people who aren't going to be happy with this. There's going to be a lot of noise. Don't worry about it. I will deal with that. And that's my job. You guys focus on what you need to do to get your job done. And that it was like taking a huge weight off their shoulders. And what a lot of leaders don't realize is even though the attacks feel personal or they're coming to you at the top, your whole organization feels it, right? They read the papers too. By telling them that that's not their problem, you know, let us deal with that. And you know, you go out and execute. It's like taking a huge weight off their shoulders, and they're able to go do that. So that's how we managed it. And you know, it got more intense as it got close to the fall, particularly around the pandemic, you know, when we were going to open up. But people were in good spirits because they saw the progress we were making. And we got our lab open. We got the testing done. We got our infirmary open. And, you know, our hospital never went into a crisis standard of care. We were winning. And when we had outbreaks, we identified them quickly and put them down. And that was a source of pride for the entire community. You know, at the end of the day, we let our success, you know, speak for ourselves. We didn't go out and crow about it. Like I said, we didn't talk about our success in the papers. We didn't take interviews. You know, we went out and we executed. And that's a big source of pride for our community.
Yeah, that ability to keep executing on a strategy is actually one place that a lot of institutions fall down. And it's hard enough to create a strategy, especially in a turnaround situation, and when you've got all of those competing interests. So it's one thing to set strategy, but it's entirely a different ballgame, I think, to execute. And your ability, I think, to keep people on track through all of those crises was absolutely crucial. What are you going to do now that I'm touching wood as I say this, but you know, now that there's no more crises on the horizon, what are you going to do to maintain that sense of forward momentum and we're all in this together?
Yeah. Well, we're still heading towards our objectives that we set 3 years ago, right? Increased enrollments. We had the largest class in our history last year and the second largest incoming class in our history this year. So our enrollments, are up, and that's all around student success. So it's not only just getting them here, but keeping them here, which we're also making improvements on. And so we've set our goals there and we're moving towards those. The other was getting to R1. And just recently there's an article in the Chronicle that just basically said, with some of the changes coming with ACE, they expect some universities to fall out of R1 and others to go in. And we're one of the ones that they mentioned going in. So
not everyone's going to know what R1 is or why it's important.
Yeah. Thank you for stopping me there. R1 is a Carnegie classification for research intensity, and R1 institutions are the highest level of research intensity. And the reason that's important is because R1 institutions get, the vast majority of awards and grants and federal subsidies for the research that is done and underwritten by the federal government. And we've been incredibly successful there. Our awards over the last 2 years are up 40%, and that was before we got the largest grant in our history, a $55 million grant for climate smart agriculture in the state. So we made incredible progress there. And again, we set that as a goal. Frankly, it had been a goal before, Heidi, but there was no plan to get there. So we put together a working group because that's the way we operate here. Very diverse working group, and they came back with the recommendations, and we've been executing on that. And now we're on the verge of being recognized as an R1 institution.
That's super cool. I have to admit that some of this actually feels quite personal to me. Not just because I had the opportunity to work with your senior leadership team, and then faculty senate, and a whole other set of individuals there, and I was so inspired by them. But it feels personal to me for two other reasons. One is I'm a first-gen student myself, right? And so, I didn't have people to look to when I was applying to university. I didn't have people to look to help me through some pretty big decisions around, majors and all of those kinds of things. And what the university is doing, not just to, as you mentioned, attract new students and first-gens, but to help them succeed, I think is really powerful. And the other reason it's personal for me is actually, I grew up in Amish country. I was surrounded by farms in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And I think that some of the research that's going on at the University of Idaho right now is super cool, right? I mean, people might be like, farming, right? Surrounded by, people here at a university who, might not be doing such tangible research as agricultural research. It's really quite fascinating to me to see what the university is doing. Give us a sense of one of those, cool projects that's going on in the agricultural sphere.
Yeah. So we probably got three large ones, the Deep Soil Ekotron facility is one we're all very proud of. We're building the world's most advanced deep soil ekotron, where you can study soil, down 3 feet and more. And the reason that's important is that there's a lot of living organisms and things happening below the soil that people are just, unaware of. And we're just really learning about it now. And it has a lot to do with soil capture. It has a lot to do with plant health. Has a lot to do about our the future success of agriculture, within the United States as the climate continues to warm up. So we can test all that in this advanced facility. People are excited. We've already got people from around the world lined up who want to use it once we have it operational, and it'll probably become operational, if I remember right, sometime next summer. So we're getting there. We're getting it built. But we're also building the largest research dairy in the country because, dairies can be pretty hard on the environment. And this is underwritten by industry. Industry has helped us do this along with the federal government because they want these answers too. How can they reduce greenhouse emissions? How can they protect the soil? How can they protect the water? And you know, my hats are off to you know, the beef and dairy industries in our state, which are huge here. They actually want to address these problems rather than run from them, and we're there to help them.
Yeah, that's super cool. I mean, when you're talking about all of these different interested parties coming together to tackle something as crucial as the future of agriculture in our country, you know, and tackling climate change issues at the same time. I mean, I can't think of a better example of smarter collaboration. So
it's super exciting.
So bring us home then, Scott. Tell us, you know, what's on the horizon for the university? What's, you know, the next big thing that you want to do as president and taking the university forward?
Yeah. So really, we're looking at, as you may be aware, affiliating with the University of Phoenix. And that's really just, you know, to help reposition ourselves, you know, for the future. There's a big enrollment cliff coming. You know, most university presidents are aware of this. Beginning in 2025, it's from the last recession back in 2009 and 10, where there were fewer children being born. And now those children are reaching, you know, college age. So there's going to be a large decline in the number of traditional students. So we are looking to affiliate with the University of Phoenix, which is their cohort is, you know, adult learners. The average age is 38. And that's a population that's actually growing, you know. So we, you know, we see a real opportunity there to affiliate with them to create new pathways to our rural-based students in the state to, you know, do more hybrid work between traditional, you know, in-person and online learning and take advantage of the systems that they have that are incredible. So we're trying to reposition ourselves so that, you know, like every crisis that we faced, we come out stronger than we've gone in. And I think this is the next challenge we're looking at is the enrollment cliff. And I'm pretty excited about where we're headed as a university. I think we're going to come out of it just fine and well positioned for the future.
Well, fantastic. President Scott Green of the University of Idaho, it's been such a pleasure catching up with you and hearing about your leadership and smarter collaboration at the university. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Heidi. Appreciate it.
So in this episode with President Scott Green of the University of Idaho, I think we heard some incredible lessons about collaboration and especially about collaborative leadership. One of my big takeaways is how crucial it is to establish shared goals. Now, I know that every leader knows that, but how do you actually put it into action? And Scott has such experience doing this in very, very practical ways that he shared with us. One of the things to think about is setting quantifiable goals and then holding people accountable for it. I think it's absolutely crucial. And it was countercultural at the university for a president to do that. And yet it really helped keep people on track. And it helped people in the sense of the collective. Everyone knew that everyone else was pulling their weight because they were all under this sense of mutual accountability to each other, to the university, to these goals that they had set amongst themselves. I think that was really, really powerful. I loved how Scott described the purpose of holding people accountable. It wasn't monthly meetings so they could beat people up and make them feel like lesser leaders because they hadn't hit goals. It was to help people stay on track. And he described those meetings, you know, what can we do to support you? What kinds of resources do you need? And I think that kind of leadership allows people to take some risks, to go out on a limb and really pull their weight collectively towards some of those bigger goals that required everyone to be collaborating across those traditional silos. I think, you know, it also speaks to the point of not just setting a strategy. You know, when President Green came in, he told us they were losing $20 million a year. And within 12 months, they'd managed not only to close that gap, but actually to make a small surplus. It speaks to the power of what they were accomplishing. But there's a huge difference between setting goals and setting a strategy and keeping people on target to do that. So you know, what we heard is part of his power comes from empowering other people, turning them loose and giving them the support that they need while also making sure that they were able to bring their unique perspectives, their different points of view to challenge each other and to create something incredibly powerful together. And then last, I think it's worth talking about his perspective as a leader. One point was that you can't be a good leader and you can't be a good collaborator if you don't take care of yourself. He emphasized the value of things like eating healthy, exercising, you know, getting up early for his workout, spending time with the right people. And this is incredibly hard to do. It's actually quite easy to do the opposite in times of crisis and stress to say, well, I'll put off my workouts until things, you know, pass and we're back on track. And instead, he gave some really clear examples of when he had made mistakes, not taking care of himself, and how he took his own advice and did some different practices the next time they faced a crisis. And I think it's a good lesson for all of us to role model that kind of self-care as a way to actually be there and a stronger leader for other people. So those were some of my takeaways. I would love to hear from everyone else what you thought the key takeaways today were. And I hope this empowers everyone here to become a stronger, more collaborative leader. So our special thanks again to our guest, Scott Green, the president of the University of Idaho and the author of the very newly released book, University President's Crisis Handbook. Until next time, remember smarter collaboration. You can go fast alone, but you can go further together.
We hope that you enjoyed today's Smarter Collaboration. This show is produced by Success Made to Last Productions in Austin, Texas, and was created by Gardner and collaborators. Executive producer is Rick Tocchini, and today's show was written by Dr. Heidi Gardner and Christine Dunn. Sound design and post-production were led by Heather Barnes and Carla Tocchini. And our operations manager is Marie Ross. This podcast can be heard wherever podcasts are distributed and also on gardnerandco.co and successmadetolast.com. And remember, smarter collaboration leads to breakthrough outcomes. Have a great week.